Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 27 of our Disney Bracket. This week we will be discussing 1961's 101 Dalmatians, as well as 2002's Lilo and Stitch. Also, we don't have to have a trigger warning this episode.
Yay!
So, let's talk about how these two films got here.
So, Lilo and Stitch went up against Aladdin
in round one. That was the very tough choice. Really, what it came down to is, as much as we love Aladdin, the songs are great, the story is pretty good, but there's a lot of very subtle racism.
Mm-hmm. Or Lilo and Stitch is more complicated about that. Also, I think there is better gender stuff.
Definitely.
There are two whole women in the narrative.
And it's at least Disney understood that there were issues with Lilo and Stitch. You can see that in a lot, in a few of the deleted scenes, and even some of the ones that remained in the film. That's mostly why Aladdin did not move past round one.
Yeah. And there's Hercules.
Which, again, another film that I enjoy quite a bit. But Hercules is kind of a mess of a film.
It's a really fun mess, but Lilo and Stitch has a more cohesive through line.
Hercules felt like it was trying to be topical about some issue of our time with the athletic sponsorships and all that sort of stuff, and it didn't really work.
Whereas Lilo and Stitch is weirdly timeless. Like, I'm not actually all that sure what time period Lilo and Stitch takes place in. I mean, ostensibly the present day, but
I figured it was, you know, contemporary to its time, so early 2000s.
Sure. Then on the flip side, we've got 101 Dalmatians, who went up against Emperor's New Groove. And I was really shocked that 101 beat out Emperor's New Groove, honestly. I hadn't seen 101 Dalmatians in a long time, so seeing how dang good it is and how well it holds up was impressive.
Again, Emperor's New Groove is not a bad film. We both really enjoy it. Mostly it came down to some of the issues of the production. They just couldn't quite get past. Some parts of the film do feel a bit rushed. There are things like Cusco's redemption doesn't feel terribly earned. And there's also not a single Latino actor in the entire cast, which is weird.
Yeah. Did we talk during that episode at all about how they have the same villain, basically? At least design-wise? Two purple ladies with pointy cheeks.
I don't think we brought it up, but that is a very valid point.
Yeah, we'll have to go back and edit the whole. We're starting over now, basically. We're starting from that episode and going again.
But that means we have to watch Pinocchio and Chicken Little again.
It stays. It's fine. Never mind. And then Tarzan versus 101.
In round two. That was a bit more difficult. Unfortunately, as with a lot of our decisions, it kind of comes down to racism.
This keeps happening, unfortunately.
Well, it's not our fault. We didn't make the films.
True. Also, Tarzan is fun, but it's a little like Hercules and it's kind of doing a lot of things, whereas 101 has a coherent thing going on.
Yeah. It also didn't help that you were not a huge fan of the music.
That's true. I was not.
Well, I do not agree, but I understand.
I mean, I do like the music. I just don't think it's well used. Kind of like if you put Carly Rae Jepsen's Cut to the Feeling in any scene in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, it probably wouldn't really fit the tone. It would improve the scene, but it wouldn't really fit the tone.
So that's where we're at with both of these films.
We talked a little bit before we were recording about how these episodes are kind of tackling the same theme but from different directions, that being community support for our problem versus community failing to give adequate support to people in crisis.
Going back a little bit, both these films at their core are about reuniting families. The
nobody gets left behind
or forgotten.
And I think their different approaches definitely come down to the times that they were made. We have 101 Dalmatians happening in the early 60s, and this is not terribly long after the rebuilding of England after the Blitz.
And while that is a complicated history, there's definitely a over-narrative of collaboration and community spirit that ran through the time period.
Mm-hmm. Whereas with Lilo and Stitch, this is coming off of the lull of the 90s, where everything was relatively safe for the heterosexual white male, at least.
Right. The people making the films.
I actually just read an article today by film crit Hulk that dives into the myopia of media in the 90s, and it's really, really good. You should read it.
Yeah, link in the description.
Although, right before the release of Lilo and Stitch, although during its production and after most of its like voice acting had been in the can, we had 9/11 happen.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons that the chase scene that was originally intended to go through downtown Honolulu with the spaceships flying through the city was changed to, you know, just over the Hawaiian mountains.
Despite being technically a 2000 movie, it feels very pre-9/11, just with this kind of sense of communalism that kind of ceased being a thing when the xenophobia of the 9/11 of the post-9/11 world happened.
I mean, people do love to talk about how, oh, we all came together as Americans, but as someone growing up during that time period, that is not how I remember it. We had people angry with the French for our decision with Iraq and decided to start calling them freedom fries instead. We were not very good at coming together in those few years.
No.
I mean, in general, but right, especially during those few years.
Yeah. Whereas Lilo and Stitch is 100% a things are at their best when everybody has a place at the table narrative. And we'll probably get into this more later, but at the end you see that Lilo and Nani and Stitch and the aliens who have been left on Earth and Cobra Bubbles are all just hanging out and having family dinners together, like collectively, and rebuilding the house together, and it's really sweet. They have all these different skills they're bringing to the table.
There's also the fact that the anti-government and anti-authority themes of the narrative would never have flown if it was released any later than after 9/11 than it had been.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, it was more or less already in the can when things were going down, so they didn't really have time to change it, but I could definitely see how that would have been a lot different.
Yes.
Whereas 101 Dalmatians is less anti-authoritarian and more anti-rich people, I guess. It definitely has some thoughts about the upper class and the lower class, but the upper class especially.
At its core, it is a heiress who has not gotten what she wants, hiring a bunch of low-class criminals to steal puppies from this new middle-class up-and-coming family.
Yeah.
It kind of wears those sort of class politics on its sleeve.
Mm-hmm. Especially with Hell Hall being this kind of decaying ruin, that it sort of seems to be suggesting that the traditional British aristocracy of the past is no longer needed, no longer important, no longer relevant, is in decline, and will eventually be phased out by these new yuppies, and then the class system will be over. It's really weird that they made this right between Sleeping Beauty and Sword in the Stone, which are very monarchic.
Yeah.
Speaking of Sleeping Beauty, just so I can get this in while we're here, a thing I noticed is that Cruella's smoke that she breathes out is really reminiscent of Maleficent's fire, which is in her dragon form. And since these came out one after the other, it was a cool way to link the two villains visually.
I definitely see that. Honestly, that may be one of the reasons that Cruella is thought of as this very rememberable villain,
mm-hmm,
even though she is relatively low on the power scale.
Yeah. Although definitely, like, very flamboyant. Like, she's memorable more as a character than as a threat.
Although she does have the best superpower. Money.
Gods. Speaking of things that are the best, I, having now watched every Disney film ever, basically, sort of, except for all the ones I haven't seen, I think 101 Dalmatians has my favorite animation style of the 2D movies. There are other ones that have nicer animation, that do more with lighting and color and reflections and that kind of stuff, that have better visuals, but this style where it creates the effect of motion blur and backgrounds being out of focus by having these only somewhat drawn in backgrounds that gesture at shapes with color instead of having everything specific and outlined and crisp is really, really cool, and I'm really into it. And during the boring bit with the Colonel during the Twilight Bark scene, I just muted the thing and just looked at the images, and it was pleasant. It was like looking at a Rothko painting, just zoning out and looking at all the colors and lines that were in there. It's really beautiful, and it still looks nice.
101 Dalmatians, the backgrounds especially, are very painterly, and I really like that about it.
Mm-hmm. And there's nothing else like it. Like, I mean, bits of Sword in the Stone, but even that doesn't quite have that same, I guess, gestural quality.
Yeah, and we don't, unfortunately, don't get as many gorgeous landscapes in that film either. I wouldn't say necessarily it's my favorite, but it's definitely up there. It has a very unique style that works incredibly well for setting the tone and the setting of the film.
Yes. Not that Lilo Stitch's animation isn't great also. It's also really pretty. And the way that a lot of things move in a very liquid way, you have these very fluid forms, because they're not super dedicated to these models staying concrete, works well with the aquatic themes around the movie.
Mm-hmm. You also have lots of round shapes, and they go back to watercolor as opposed to gouache, which we talked about in a previous episode about the film. Although musically, there are two good songs in 101 Dalmatians. There's Cruella de Vil, and then I'm a personal fan of Dalmatian Plantation.
Mm.
But some of the others are just kind of there, unfortunately. And there's also some very odd choices. Like, so there's the scene where the Dalmatians are hiding from Jasper and Horace under the bridge on the frozen creek. And that whole scene happens. And then they're walking down the creek to avoid leaving footprints. And the choice of very upbeat music there doesn't make lots of sense. You know, it's, oh, these puppies are slipping and sliding on the ice, and oh, isn't it cute? But they're escaping for their lives. It seems like a poor decision to put that music there.
You're not wrong, although I could see how they might have been trying to start that sequence off on a light note, so that as it gets worse, it will hit harder. So I think if it started grim and then kept being grim all the way up to...
And my tail's froze, and my nose is froze, and my ears are froze.
Then it might have, you know, gotten too heavy, but having that moment of levity was okay to me, I guess.
I think the transition between the scenes of almost getting caught and then doing this was a little bit too abrupt. I think if they would have toned down the music at least a little bit, maybe not as dour as it is during the blizzard, but it definitely felt way too upbeat for me.
Speaking of interesting music choices, Lilo and Stitch, we've seen it 3 times now. How do you feel about the Elvis?
It makes sense for Lilo as a character.
Oh, sure.
With her sort of fascination of tourists and this tourist culture and all that sort of stuff. I think it works well for the most part. I do tend to prefer the Elvis covers in the soundtrack as opposed to just his music straight up, but I don't find it weird or not well thought out.
I'm not sure if the song lyrics always lined up with what was happening on screen, but I could also understand if that's just like these are the ones they had rights to, or that's just, you know, what Lilo had on record at the time.
They also definitely went with lots of his more well-known stuff as opposed to things that maybe would have been more tonally appropriate. But I also, again, I understand picking the hits.
Sure. I don't really know anything about Elvis, so I don't really know what was big. Speaking of media in the universe, I would totally watch What's My Crime. I'm really sad that Netflix hasn't, like, done that yet. They make, like, 18,000 shows a month. They might as well just make What's My Crime a thing.
On one hand, I feel you, but on the other, with the way the American justice and incarceration system is at the time, then using inmates to profit off of by showing them on a game show seems bad.
You're not wrong. And while that's a kind of fun criminal element, Jasper's violence during the drunk scene is upsetting, and I always forget about how not pulling of punches they are with that.
Yeah, and the whole color palette changes during that scene. I think it's very effective.
Oh, yeah.
There's also some of that with Cruella. There's some foreshadowing with her reprimanding Jasper and Horace for their poor driving.
And what's your driving, you imbeciles? You want to get nabbed by the police?
But then that being exactly what leads to all of them getting captured. And specifically during that scene, we get the same sort of color palette change, and Cruella's eyes go wide and reddened and, for lack of a better term, crazed looking.
She gets really cartoonish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the strengths of the 101 Dalmatians style, is they can do that and have it be really effective. Especially because most of the film has these really cool tones, and both of those scenes switch to a very warm palette.
And having it be set in the snow at dawn means the overwashing of these reddish tones that are mostly pink, but then have like the red accents fits and doesn't feel forced the way it would if it was just like, oh, the snow is bleeding, like in Watership Down. Another cool animation thing, I like the bits of effort they put in with stuff, how there's reflection on the frozen stream, or how the stars twinkle during the midnight bark scene.
Yeah, those little subtle things are really nice. Although there's some other weird, maybe somewhat problematic stuff that I notice.
Sure.
So Cruella shows up for the first time, and Perdita's still pregnant. She asks about the puppies. Well, they won't be here for another few weeks. And Cruella goes off. And Pongo goes to see how Purdy's doing, and she's very stressed out. She talks about,
I wish we weren't having any.
And then pretty much the very next scene is Pongo's narration over that right before the birth. He says,
poor Perdita. Of course, she had no choice.
And when you're talking about choice and reproductive rights of women...
Yeah, I mean, it's the 60s.
Yeah, this is 61. This is right when those sorts of legal battles were at their peak.
Right. And also, like, I'm not sure how far along Purdy was. Shockingly, I'm not well-versed on what safe abortion times are for dogs. I'm not sure if it was, like, intentional comment on the current politics or if it just sort of happened to work out that way.
At best, it's pretty poor phrasing. And then I was watching this with my wife, and I had also made this connection before, but kind of thought better of mentioning it because it felt like I was looking too closely at it. But because someone else had brought it up who was not watching as closely as I was, I figured best to mention it. But there is somewhat this component of blackface during the Labrador soot scene.
I'm not sure if it's intentional and they're like going for that thing, or if it's that it happens to resemble that and they didn't realize it because this is made by a bunch of white people. It's not enough for me to be like, oh, this is definitely awful. It is enough for me to be like,
yeah, I don't have the expertise to make a final judgment on this, but it does seem weird. But it's also complicated by the fact that, yes, these dogs are very much personified as humans, but they don't have the same sort of prejudice as we do. That, like, there isn't this long-standing prejudice against black labs.
Right.
And while, yes, they're covering their fur in this black soot, they don't have a lot of the other stereotypical blackface markers like the large lips and all that sort of other stuff.
I'm not saying it's not out there, but I wasn't able to find anybody like talking about it definitively beyond a relatively recent upswing of people going,
I also know that there was the live action remake, but I don't recall if that scene was included in that because it's been so long since I've watched it. And if so, if there was any backlash then. It seems that people would more likely be talking about that as opposed to this film that came out in 61.
If people have complaints about it, I totally understand. And I'm not going to say you can't. I don't know how to feel.
With my uninformed white opinion, it doesn't feel like that grievous of a thing. But I could also be completely wrong and uneducated. I don't know. So those were my just weird, is this problematic moments of this watch through. I've got to kind of get into the nitty gritty stuff at this point with 101.
Oh, speaking of nitty gritty though with 101, you talked before about how Cruella's relationship with Anita definitely has that like abusive friend dynamic, and that Roger's being pretty solid for being like, hey, this is a problematic friend, you shouldn't get rid of that. A thing I noticed this time through where they're definitely working on that, Cruella's in the house the first time and she's trying to pet Pongo, and Pongo's not about it. And instead of saying, hey, my dog's bothered by you, you should stop that, Anita says, oh, hey, is that a new fur coat? And it's not uncommon for people who are in toxic relationships to try to pivot from talking about problems instead of addressing them head on. And that's definitely a solid example of that. So good job, Disney. You isolated a problem.
That scene also really gives you a good idea of where Cruella comes from. As soon as Anita mentions the fur coat, Cruella goes off on this short diatribe about furs and,
after all, is there a woman in all this wretched world who doesn't?
And I wasn't around in 61, but definitely feels like there's a lot of women who would not.
Probably. I mean, there were some feelings. That said, I have like a fake fur thing, and it does feel nice. I get it. And I'm glad we have the technology to make that without actually having to skin puppies or other animals.
Yeah, let's go ahead and pivot over to Lilo and Stitch.
Sure. While we're talking about heavy things, have we talked about Lilo and Stitch and autism yet?
I think we've mentioned it, that there are some people who have read Lilo as autistic.
It seems like there's a decent number of people who have found that to be a relatable portrayal, even if it wasn't unintentional. Mm. And I'm glad that like people were able to connect to a character in that way. That's cool. We don't have like many autistic heroes ever. So having one who is maybe coded as autistic is coolish.
We're starting to get specifically labeled autistic characters in media. There's a few shows like coming out right now. There's The Good Doctor and Atypical. And there are some issues with those sorts of portrayals. But I've also seen a lot of people on the spectrum who are talking about other characters who are not specifically labeled as autistic, but have similar traits or are relatable to those people. And like we talked about Lilo, there's also Drax from the Guardians of the Galaxy trilogy. I've seen quite a number of people talk about him as well, especially his inability to get sarcasm.
Same with Cyclops, oddly enough, from the X-Men. Lilo's a really good character, and I appreciate all the depth that she gets. Every time I watch it, I see new things that I like about her. Especially in the expression they give to her. It's the subtleties of her character animation allow you to figure out a lot about where she is, which is really important for a character who isn't always super verbal, both because she's a child and also potentially on the spectrum.
While we're talking about heavy stuff in Lilo and Stitch, there's also some minor issues of consent with the old woman in the hotel.
Oh, yeah. I keep forgetting about that, but yeah.
It's a sort of blink and you miss it scene, but it's during the A plot of Nani trying to get a job and B plot of Lilo trying to turn Stitch into Elvis.
You know, when you put it like that, it's a really weird movie.
But in that scene, Nani's trying to get a concierge job and Lilo is teaching Stitch about how to handle the ladies, so to speak. And Lilo gives him a rose, and he's like,
"She looks like she could use some lovin'."
Stitch sits down on the couch next to this older woman and grabs her hand, and the old lady looks up from her paper and kind of like stares, and back to Nani at the concierge just trying to look for a job, and then you hear screaming from off screen. And on one hand, again, we're dealing with a small child and their understanding of how romance works, especially consuming media from decades ago, which is obviously not going to be up to modern standards. And they don't show the kiss on screen at all. Relatively minor, but it's still a little weird and problematic.
Yeah, I don't have like a good thought or fix for that.
You could pretty easily just cut that scene and the rest of the film would be fine.
Yeah.
It's just a relic of 16 years ago.
Right. Actually, to pull on that thread a little bit, Lilo does not always seem to have a great grasp on, I don't say other people's bodily autonomy, but like on boundaries. There's that bit where she slams the door and like definitely hits Donnie's head, even though they weren't in a conflicting place at the time. And punching Myrtle, which...
And biting.
You bit her.
Which, I'm not saying Myrtle didn't kind of do things to provoke that, but Lilo definitely isn't great about holding back expression. They don't quite pull on that thread enough to really make that a flaw that they're unpacking in the character. I'm also not saying that Disney should do a teaching consent to 8-year-olds narrative. That sounds almost as bad as a Disney Tackle the AIDS Crisis movie.
Or a live-action Lilo and Stitch remake.
God.
Which is apparently coming.
It's going to go very badly. How are they going to get anybody better than Nani? Like, Nani is so good.
Best case scenario, we can hope for some really great Pacific Islander actors to either be discovered or get their name out there quite a bit more due to the film.
Yeah, I suppose.
That's about the best we can hope for.
Yeah, which, I mean, that would be very good.
Like we talked about, the art style is one of the great things about Lilo and Stitch, and I'm not sure how you're going to translate that to live action very well.
I'm also really worried that they're going to make Nani thin. It's not that Nani is a particularly fat character, but she definitely has weight on her, and I really appreciate that it's a thing. I mean, she's still seen as desirable as a character by David, who's great. I like that she gets to have some aspect of romantic and sexual attraction. Like, I like the doofiness of she likes her butt and fancy hair.
She thinks it's fancy?
I love David. He's so good.
That's another nice similarity that these films have, is that both of the romantic male leads are, like, really good.
Mm-hmm. The worst bit of Pongo is he's, I guess, a bit judgy with other dogs, but...
I was talking about Roger.
Oh. Well.
I'm sure our furry audience that probably exists will appreciate that, though.
But that does tie into our conversation last time about how we don't feel uncomfortable with David's saying, oh, no, you're the only one, you can just date me instead, because Lilo has given him this information that Nani has interest in him. It's not coercive. It's just, I know you want to. Not in a bad way, but in a, like, I literally have the knowledge that you want to.
There's also the fact that Nani has pretty much told David, like, I would like to, but there is this obstacle in my way of making sure that I have a job and I'm taking care of Lilo. And, like, David is specifically like, I am helping you overcome this obstacle to make sure that you have a job so you can take care of Lilo. And that maybe possibly allows us to pursue our romantic relationship.
I'm not saying that I want this movie to not have aliens in it, because I would never say that about anything. But there were times when they were having these really small, quiet moments where I'm like, oh, right, this is a space drama, as well as a tight, small family drama. And I guess we can go back to that. I love the small quietness of Lilo and Nani just being bickering sisters, or singing to each other, or them playing on the beach. If the other aliens had never found Stitch, and he was just gone and lived there, and we never saw Space Queen Tilda Swinton or anybody else again, I think it would have been a still fine narrative.
It would. I don't have a problem with it, but that's mostly because of how Lilo's and Stitch's, their two main plots, are pretty much mirrored throughout the entire process. I'm going to go on a long rant here for a little bit. Take a look at it more closely. Both Lilo as well as Stitch's conflicts all amount to the government doing a poor job of dealing with a child that has gone through a trauma and is not being taken care of.
Yes, I wanted to talk about this, yes.
Like, looking back, I don't know why it took me three watch-throughs to get here, but it did. If we look at it, Jumba created Stitch, so we can think of Jumba as Stitch's father. However, because of the circumstances that he was created, Stitch's inherent existence is illegal, which, shitty.
Yes, no child is illegal.
And Jumba specifically created and molded Stitch to be an agent of destruction. He has shown that he is not a good parent. The council, upon, you know, interacting with Stitch and saying, well, maybe he could be reformed, gives him one shot. Stitch has a potty mouth, and then that is enough to imprison Jumba and then decide there is no way that we can reform this creature, their words, not mine, and decide to just banish him for all eternity.
Also, as far as we know, Stitch has been alive for months, maybe a year or two, and no government that puts a, like, one-year-old child on trial and expects them to decide the rest of their life should be allowed to persist in any kind of child care. Luckily, that would never happen in real life.
And then on top of that, the council is proven grossly mistaken, because a, what, 7-ish-year-old child who is completely ill-equipped to foster Stitch's emotional growth, because hers is completely stunted by the death of her parents, and now being raised by her 16-to-18-year-old sister, while a social worker is breathing down their necks trying to take Lilo away from her, is able to reform Stitch in a matter of about a week.
By teaching him some Elvis, giving him a tour of Hawaii, giving him a lay, and reading him a book. And a few other things, but, you know.
There are lots of similarities to the U.S. government, specifically portrayed by Cobra Bubbles, and then the Galactic government, portrayed by Pleakley and Gantu, as well as the Councilwoman. And they are complete failures to take care of these kids. They spend all these resources trying to fix the problem, but they're spending the resources inadequately. If instead of spending all of his time trying to take Lilo away, Cobra worked on actually helping Nani get to a place where she could take care of Lilo, she'd be in a much better place. And if the council decided to just attempt to rehabilitate Stitch, then they wouldn't have needed this intergalactic goose chase and to cause all sorts of havoc on Earth. And the thing is, the movie itself proves it, because after Stitch's sentence is commuted to his banishment on Earth and the Pelikai family is placed under Galactic Federation protection, which I also assume means that they're getting a stipend for being the ones incarcerating Stitch.
The wardens.
Yeah, so to speak. Nani and Lilo and Stitch all thrive under that arrangement, and as soon as they have the resources to take care of themselves and to provide for themselves, that's all they needed.
Mm-hmm. So I made a Punnett square for good and bad, and then fix, rebuild versus dump and abandon. There's got to be one time when dumping and abandoning a thing was the good choice, and about, I think I got to 15 before I gave up, where that was the wrong choice, whereas like persisting and fixing and trying again with something was the wrong choice twice, maybe. And then I got to about 20 where people were trying to fix or rebuild something, and it was the right thing and things got better because of it. It's very clearly stressing that you can't just give up on things. You have to put in the effort to make them better, and they will be. And you're right that it definitely has a material aspect to it too. Like, Nani doesn't have time or funding to take care of a child, but then like you get some cool space uncles who can help build a new house, and they thrive.
I'm going to put in a pin in the cool space uncles, because I have thoughts about Jumba. But but as we're talking about this government, we didn't bring it up in the podcast specifically, but on the announcement of the episode post on Facebook, we got a question about the council and really our opinions on their goodness. And looking closely, the Galactic Council is not very good in a lot of aspects, especially with their willingness to completely gas an entire planet because a fugitive that they let escape happened to wind up there. And it makes a lot of sense with that portrayal if you consider the Galactic Federation, their relationship with Earth, as a metaphor for the United States' relationship with sovereign Hawaii prior to their annexation.
Yeah. It shouldn't be all that surprising. I mean, our first scene of them is them framed from below, making them feel more intimidating in a relatively dark room with stark lighting that feels harsh as opposed to bright. The room is reminiscent of the Galactic Council from Star Wars prequels, which came out at about the same time, but definitely have that same like sinister government machination vibe as opposed to anything small and personal. Also, you have hundreds or thousands of aliens gathered for this one trial, which seems like a waste of resources. And I mean, there's also that bit where Gantu puts Stitch's head in his blaster and then the other guy says,
"May I remind the captain that he is on duty?"
Not, "Hey, it would be wrong to shoot a defenseless creature, but hey, you're on duty." Let's ramp it back a little bit.
Jumba's redemption arc is completely non-existent. There's just a point in the film where he stops doing and saying awful things, and then we're supposed to start liking him because he's helping Stitch get Lilo back.
Just like that!
You know, then he transitions into this uncle role and helps rebuild the Pelikai house and builds Lilo and Stitch all these fun toys and all that sort of stuff. And it feels completely unearned because of how poorly he treats Stitch and just how much of a general jerk he is.
I get you. While it's not necessarily unbelievable, it definitely does feel rushed. And this movie had time. They could have done other things than the like chase scene. If he hadn't become the cool uncle, I would have been okay with it. He's seemed like a very mercurial character, and I'd understand if he kind of just decided to get back to the government because lols. But him having a vuncular role afterwards definitely did his own unpacking.
After seeing and talking about a number of really good redemption arcs with Moana and Beauty and the Beast, seeing this one here is just, no, it's bad.
Although what is a good redemption arc is Stitch.
Yes.
Yeah. I hope parts of Lilo and Stitch are hard to watch because Stitch is a jerk and I'm like, no, please don't hurt Lilo. She's so good and pure. How dare you hurt the only goth kid in Hawaii? Circling back to how they definitely had time to talk about the redemption for Jumba, Leland Stitch on the first watch through is fine about this, but having watched it several times, the action scenes in the third act kind of wear thin on me. It seemed like they were just throwing in every joke and idea and image and action scene they thought of with kind of a all ideas are good ideas approach. I don't think we needed it to last as long. There's a lot of different moves from when the fight in the Pelikai house starts to when everybody landed on the beach that has a lot of characters just kind of bouncing around, not really strictly growing and changing. There is some of that in there, but especially once they're in the ships, it's just space punch-ups. And it's not bad, per se, but they could have shaved off 2 or 3 minutes of that and given it to character arc for Jumba, if they wanted to, or putting in that one scene with the air raid siren, or a scene of David cooking or something. There's more David. David and Aldar talking about how they're the most neglected of the Disney men. And some of the jokes are great. Like,
oh good, my dog found the chainsaw.
Is amazing. But on the flip side, we don't need that scene to be there. It's kind of like the mouse chases in Cinderella, where it's just action for action.
Yeah. There are a few lines from Lilo in the house fight that I think, like, I would not remove. And then during the chase scene in the spaceships, I would not get rid of them knocking the dude's ice cream cone over one last time.
No, preserve that at all costs. But the part where Stitch falls to Earth, steals a gas truck, activates it with the
lava flow.
Yeah. It's not a bad scene. It's not, like, badly done or doesn't... I don't care that it, like, it's physics or whatever. It's just him falling and getting back up without evolving that much as a character.
It also is a pretty long sequence to get back up.
Yeah.
It is getting to be about that time.
Sure.
Final thoughts?
No, I think I've covered everything from the one that I think is probably not moving on this week, so...
One last thing I do want to say. I do love the line in 101 Dalmatians where... Nanny's like,
well, I don't care what Parliament realm or whatever it is says. You're not coming in here, not with the Mr. and the Mrs. gone.
Nanny is great.
Yeah. But with that, I think Lilo and Stitch is moving on.
Mm-hmm. I love 101 Dalmatians, and it's an easier watch. It doesn't have that scene where Bubbles is throwing Lilo in the car and he and Nanny are arguing and Bubbles is making really good points and it's incredibly painful to watch because it's really realistic and heartbreaking. But I think Lilo is a more necessary story that unpacks issues of communalism and resource scarcity better than 101 does.
Yeah. Again, I love 101, but it just doesn't have as much going on as Lilo and Stitch does. It's a good movie, and I also really love just how personified all the dogs are, and it's very much their narrative as opposed to the narrative of Roger and Nita against Cruella. But this week I was struggling to talk about new things with it.
Yeah. And there's probably more stuff we can unpack, but it's run its course and now I can go to bed.
So what do we have coming up next week?
We have Lion King versus Tangled.
Ooh, that'll be an interesting one.
Yeah, they're both very well loved, use color in interesting ways, have characters whose hair grows and that is important to the plot. I'm not technically wrong about that. Anyway, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening.
If you want to make sure to keep up to date with all of our goings on, you can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, right here on Podbean. We release episodes every Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, thank you for listening to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast.